Today we're speaking again with Patrick Ryan, cult mediation specialist. Since we've been speaking about deprogramming and interventions in the Adams trial, I wanted to bring Patrick back to speak to the way these things play out in real life. Through his consultancy work, his programs, and his contributions to publications such as AFF News, The Cult Observer, Recovery from Cults, and Ethical Standards for Thought Reform Consultants, which he co-authored, Patrick Ryan has made a tremendous impact on the way we approach cultic exit strategies. The first thing I want to ask you about is interventions, because I know there's a complicated history of cultic interventions in our country, leading some people to think they aren't ethical or to question how ethical they are. So just going back, I'm wondering what it is about the way that we've historically conducted interventions that have led people to ask these questions.
Well, I think that the sort of the genesis of the intervention or deprogramming movement happened in the early 70s. And it really dealt with a couple of groups where kids disappeared and their parents didn't know where they went. And there was a gentleman named Ted Patrick who developed an approach which involved kidnapping the people and applying a fair amount of emotional and psychological pressure to convince the person that there was something wrong with what they were doing. So it's illegal, unethical. At the time, I think that families had no other alternatives in their mind, and they were afraid, and they acted. But over the years, different approaches have been developed. And so in the early 80s, there was a gentleman named Kevin Garvey. He began using a more psychologically based approach. The deprogramming world was more about, there was an idea or a belief that people sort of snapped. One day they were John, and the next day they were John Mooney, and that this sudden personality change took place. And that in some way you needed to get the person to snap back. And, I mean, it's not anything that I subscribe to or actually see. So Kevin Garvey developed an approach which was more to stimulate someone's intellect. So it was still providing information about a group that was controversial. The side of a group that would be the problematic areas. So if we look at some of the groups of today, you know, one that's very popular in the media is NXIVM, where the leader is, I think his trial starts this week. Many of the women were branded. It's pretty extreme. So I think that in the 70s, parents would probably have kidnapped their kids. Then in the 80s and into the 90s, this idea of an approach of still telling someone what was wrong with the group and primarily with a motive to get the person to leave, to sever their relationship with the group. So the approach that we use is different than both of those, although there's some similarities with the second. And that is really teaching a family how to communicate with the person they love, because the research is pretty good. Most people who join groups leave, and they leave on their own, probably 90% of the people. It's just a matter of when. Does they leave the group after a week? Is it 50 years? There's not any good evidence or instrument to be able to predict if it's a day or they're going to be there for the rest of their lives. But most people leave. So what our approach is really is concerned about those people that are questioning, those people that they have a family to come out to. Can you make an environment that is in some way attractive for the person who's in a controlling situation to sever their ties on their own? Because when you make a decision yourself and you discover for your own, for yourself, what you like or dislike about something, it holds, it sticks. But when somebody else tells you what's wrong with something, it may or may not resonate with you. So right, this evolution has taken place. So our approach is primarily about teaching families how to communicate across sort of worldviews, teaching the families to appreciate what their loved one appreciates about the group they're involved in. Because fundamentally, I believe that if you can appreciate what someone loves about something, then you have the right to criticize it. But if you think that everything they're doing is wrong, then who wants to hear that? So
right.
we could look at it in terms of an example of art. If I walk into your house and you have a painting on the wall and I said, oh, that sucks, well, we wouldn't probably have anywhere to go. But if I looked at the piece of art and I said, boy, that's really cool how the artist, you know, used red in the sky and why did they tie it to, you know, the earth with this particular tone? But I really like that, but I don't, this is confuses me, this little piece of the, you know, the painting, why the artist did that. If I can find something we have in common, then I have a right to criticize. But if I can't appreciate what the person loves about it, then I think that it's difficult and to criticize it.
That makes sense. And it sounds like what you're talking about is a communication style or a way to breach a subject
sure. In
a way that, you know, the receiving party is going to be open enough to hear it. I know that a lot of cult members are taught to shut out criticism or to like, leave if they start to receive criticism. And I'm sure some cases are more difficult than others.
Sure.
And I'm sure that sort of difficulty is what led loving family members to make controversial choices about kidnapping their own children in previous years. I read Steve Hassan's book in which he describes a sort of 72-hour period of deprogramming. And you've spoken previously about, I believe it was your sister who was in a separate cult, and through learning about her experience in a sort of formal way, you know, like reading an actual book about it, you were able to, you know, draw the connections into your own group. And those both sound like somewhat structured environments to become deprogrammed. So when you're talking about breaching these subjects with a current cult member in a way that they'll be open to hearing it, are you talking about in a structured environment or are you talking about over the course of however long?
Yeah, both. So I think that if we look at the term intervention, and often people think of this as a, you know, from what we see in TV, where families sit down around a table and tell someone what's their concerns and how this has affected them. If that's what you mean by structured, what I advocate is not that. One way to answer your question is that I believe, and it was my experience, that most people that are in groups, have lots of times where they really love being in the group, and they have a hell of a lot of times where they don't like being in the group. And so it's like the window of opportunities open and close all the time. So I know from my own group experience, a stranger could have gotten me out, but just sitting down and having a conversation at the times I wasn't happy. And then there were times where, you know, you could have brought in an army and I wouldn't have budged. The only difference is you'd have to know what was going on in my head. So if we can help families have a relationship with someone, because I believe that a relationship is more important than the belief, if we can teach them to have a relationship with them and not make every interaction, you know, like all about the group, that the person will begin to open up and, in a sense, tell you when they're ready to talk about the subject. So I think that timing has a lot more to do with success than just intervening.
That makes a lot of sense. And it really reminds me of things that I've heard about approaching people in abusive relationships and the way that I'm speaking about romantic relationships, but you could also apply the term cultic relationships to that methodology.
Exactly. Same idea. I mean, look, somebody walks into a bar, they see someone, they find it, they're attractive, some biology kicks in, and they have this, you know, this relationship starts. It's not rational. It's, you know, it's emotional. And that relationship continues for some period of time in this example I'll use. And then the person may start having doubts about the person that they're dating or they're involved with. There might be things that they find out that financially make them uncomfortable or maybe past relationships. But often we shelve those. Mm-hmm. But if a mom or dad or brother or sister goes, you know, that guy you're dating, he's a really horrible person. Oh, then you kick your heels in, right? Yeah. You don't have the right to criticize him. I can criticize him. So, but if you're open so that your child or the person you're concerned about knows that you're there and that you're not going to be judgmental and you're not going to be pushing a particular agenda, they're a lot more likely to share what they think. And I think the secret to this thing is knowing when to tell the person the information that you're concerned about and also finding what would be important to them. And this is an area I think that is a mistake that's often made in our field is that there's a group, let's say the group with the people being branded. So, oh my God, the person's being branded. So the families are freaking out. Of course they'd be freaking out. And then they tell their children, are you branded? Well, for some, that could be a big thing that they were branded. And for others, not a big thing. And right. So you have to figure out what is the hook for the person who's involved in the group. And the hook can be very different. The reason I left my group is obscure. It's like not what wouldn't make sense to anybody else. But so if I came in and started talking to someone about the group I was involved in and told them what was wrong with it, it just wouldn't jive. So we have to sort of understand why someone has fallen in love with this group or this idea and to address it. And the reality is, if there's a group with 100 members, it's like 100 different groups. And the groups, because groups change over time and place to place, and people change. And so what we're trying to look at is the interaction of a particular person at a particular time in their life with a group at a particular time in the group's life. That interaction of the two is what we want to look at. And what will affect one person can be very different than another. So this idea of a formula of you provide X amount of information, I don't know if it's so effective.
Right. Because there are too many variables to consider.
There's many variables.
How?
And so what?
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, in that case, considering the breadth of what people like you and in your field try to help others deal with, how do professionals come into the equation? How are they used, like mediators and consultants or counselors? How are they best used by concerned loved ones looking to help someone they know out of a destructive group?
So in the sort of field of people who do interventions, there are lots of different styles. Mm. And some of that's personality driven. But people hold certain beliefs. So, you know, I hold the belief that a relationship is more important, that you have a relationship with someone regardless of what they believe. That's more important because at the end of the day, if you're in a group and you leave the group and you don't have a relationship with your family or friends or someone, you don't have anything to come out to. And so I think it's really important to create that safe space on the other side. But we do have a formal process that we go through. To structure interventions. It starts with a family filling out an extraordinarily lengthy questionnaire with questions that deal with the person's past and in the family environment. And then we do an assessment, our initial sort of evaluation over the phone. And then we sit down with the family for an 8-hour session with brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, to just ask questions, to assess the situation, to see what is appropriate, and to explore what mom thinks is the problem and what dad thinks is the problem and what the brother thinks is the problem can be very different. You know, I've gone in to talk to families doing an assessment where I ask the question, is there, you know, any drug history? Parents say, absolutely not. Then when I'm interviewing the brother says, you know, my brother who's in this group was in jail for dealing drugs.
Whoa.
So you find out very, very different things from different people. So we do this very detailed assessment And we explore the ethics of intervention, what we want to sort of identify, what people's concerns are, really, why is the person involved? And then from that, we make a recommendation of, do you think that we should just focus on just maintaining a relationship? Or should we move toward, in a sense, some type of mediation where we can sit down and sort of hash it out with people who are more neutral? Or is there a necessity of actually trying to structure some type of intervention? And so all three cases, we go to a preparation phase where we spend 3 days or with the family, 3 8-hour days with about 2 or 3 hours of homework at night, where we go through sort of the mechanics of how to communicate with someone with a within a group and how one might structure an intervention. So the first question I ask families, and it always sort of upsets them, is what right do you have to interfere with your loved one? I mean, because an intervention is interfering with someone's life without their permission. So what right do you have to do that? You know, why are you doing that? So I don't personally provide negative information about a group to a family. They need to figure out why they're concerned, not why what I don't like about it. It's what they don't like about it. Because if we're sitting down with their loved one who's in a group and I'm starting to say, here's the problem. The leader stole $65 and he has, you know, three wives. Well, it might be important to me, but, you know, the parents may have been on their third marriage and the dad might have been a thief. So it wouldn't hold any water. So we have to identify what the family's concerns are. So that's how we start our preparation. And then the second question we have, which is very difficult for families, is we ask the families to come up with 50 things, 50 positive things that they can agree with are good about this relationship their loved one has with this group.
Ugh, I imagine that's very hard for some people.
It's very hard. And the funny thing is that those who cannot do that, those are the cases we're not successful with. Wow. But if we can get the family to see what the person loves about this, what they appreciate about it, then we have an area that we have of common they can have things they can talk about. Because a big problem is if you think that your loved one is involved in something that is horrendous and all you want to do is tell them how bad it is, well, then you don't have anything to talk about. But if you can find things that you have in common that you can agree about, then you have things you can talk about. So we spend about a day just coming up with each individual person, brother, sister, mom, dad, with these things that are positive. What are the good parts? Because it's not all bad. People don't join groups because everything in a group is bad. Then the next day we actually ask them to come up with the reasons that they think they should, what's wrong with it? What are their concerns? But we first want to find out what they agree with before we look at what their concerns are. And we want to identify, sort of take those concerns and distill them and teach a family how to communicate them in a way that the person in the group could hear them. And then there's you know, tremendous amount of detail on how this is done. I make it in some way sound simple, but it's really about teaching families how to communicate and teaching them what are the signals, what are the signs that the person in the group is ready to hear those.
And are there physical signs of them sort of being open to information, like in a structured setting, or do you mean more?
Well, it can be in a structured setting. I'll give you an example that's sort of unstructured. There's a client who is involved in a Eastern type group. And the family was Catholic. So the husband and wife were having conflict over the wife being involved in an Eastern group. Mm-hmm. And so she really perceived her husband as someone who wasn't spiritual. And he was sort of just like a Catholic that went to church on Sunday. And she was interested in spirituality and a little bit more depth. And so she got involved in an Eastern religious idea. So our first goal was to get the husband to stop criticizing his wife. He had attempted an intervention at one time by providing her all this negative information about the group, and it almost led to a divorce. Because every time there was an interaction, it was negative. It was uncomfortable. And who wants to have uncomfortable conversations every day? Right. So what our approach was to try to find within this man's tradition, which was Catholicism, some things that would be spiritual that his wife could see as spiritual. So we introduced him to a monk at a monastery, and the monk was it's a great guy. My colleague went to college with him, who does interfaith dialogue for the Vatican with new religious movements or cults, and with Islam. And so he began visiting this monk in the monastery about every 2 weeks, and going to the monastery and having confession as a Catholic would. And his wife would ask, why are you going to a monastery? I mean, how did you go from going from like the little parish to now you go to a monastery? He said, you know, I have a relationship with this monk that, you know, I learned. And the monk and him became friends. So his wife, who was in the Eastern group, asked to meet the monk. And after about a year, it was agreed that, okay, the monk said, okay, I'll meet her. And so she came with him one day, and they spent some time. They went through the monastery, and she noticed that, you know, the monk was reading books on Eastern religions, and he could dialogue about all kinds of things. And she then began starting to perceive her husband in a different way, that he wasn't just sort of this rigid man, that there was other levels to him, that the group had sort of got her to think of him as almost like a robot, but really he was a human being with many levels. And so helping the wife and the husband change sort of the dynamics in their relationship allowed her to begin to tell her husband when she wasn't happy. And slowly she started telling him that she really was not happy in the group. And his thing was to learn how to listen. And at some point she said, I just can't do it anymore. He said, okay, you've given it a good chance. And she went and got her stuff and didn't go back. But that took a few years to get him to be safe enough to her, safe enough to the wife, that she could share with him that she was unhappy without him saying, see, I told you so.
Wow, that's a really beautiful story. And it kind of makes me consider what you do in a new light, which is has a lot to do with emotional work, like massaging emotions. What, for example, when you have people list 50 positive attributes, that's a way of helping them step into the place that their loved one is in, and stirring that empathy up in them so that they can approach things a lot more thoughtfully and correctly. And it also has to do with easing these raw emotions. If you're very scared about for a loved one, or if you're very like righteous or angry, and that emotional intensity isn't the right energy to bring into an interaction.
Exactly. In our process, that's, you know, the questionnaire, the initial evaluation, the assessment, training families. Commonly, it could be 6, 9 months, a year before they would even meet someone like me. And during that period of time, families change. And, you know, we all know what our parents are like. And when our parents change a little bit to kids, it seems like our parents made huge strides. And so that when they begin to change, you know, their family members who are in a group want to know, well, why are you changing? And they tell them that they talk to somebody like Pat, who's helped them understand and appreciate what they like about these ideas. And that process is really a big part of the intervention. So that by the time when someone meets me, or I'm introduced, they already know who I am. They know that I've been able to get the family to stop criticizing. So I come in with credibility. And my first meeting might be for lunch for an hour. And funnily enough, most people, after I've met them or my colleague has met them, will ask us, could you come back so we could talk more? Because you've been able to do something I haven't been able to do. You've been able to get my parents to understand me.
Wow.
And so that really starts, an intervention, so that if you can distill, if a parent can distill what really is concerned from concerning them in a way their child can hear it, change takes place rapidly. But if you just take what's canned on the internet, you know, the criticisms about a particular group that are on the internet, any good group leader has inoculated people to those things. So all you do have to do is find is what's meaningful to this family. And what's meaningful to one family, it can be so different. I mean, I worked with a family recently, and after we distilled what the family's concerns were, it came down to, the mom was worried about their daughter's soul. That's really what she was worried about. Hmm. So then that's what's real. That the guru was doing all these other things, that wasn't real. And the daughter knew when the mother said, I'm worried about your soul, that was real. So then they could have a dialogue. Now, I wouldn't have known that. But what we had to do is find out, what is it? You know, what is your real concern? And that takes a lot of work on a family's part to not just get a prepackaged, here's what's right or wrong about a group. And so what I don't do is provide families with negative information about groups. They have to find out for themselves what they feel is wrong. What is so concerning to them that they think they have the right to interfere with a person's life.
As you know, I'm passionate about podcasts that tell stories and the way they enhance people's lives. I recently learned about a really creative show called Family Ghosts, which is a documentary-style storytelling podcast that investigates people's families. So many families have one person in their background whose legend or unfinished business has haunted them. A jewel-smuggling grandma or an uncle who lived a double life. A sibling who vanished. Whomever that person is, they leave behind a mystery for their families to live with. The show Family Ghosts investigates one family per episode and gives them the answers they've been waiting for. This show is immersive because they take you on the investigative journey with them, digging into the past, searching for answers. Season 2 launches on May 15th and explores the ghosts inside the Love Israel family cult, the secret life within a newly discovered stack of love letters, a container of missing Chinese food that's haunted a family for 25 years, and more. Subscribe to Family Ghosts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you get your podcasts. And take a listen to Season 1. You'll understand why they say every house is haunted.
I imagine the clients that you speak to, there's a lot of defensiveness to wade through. Like putting myself in the position of family member, I'm thinking, okay, I really believe that my loved one is in this really destructive group. I'm concerned. I'm scared. I'm going to hire a professional to help me through this process. And then the professional says to me, well, let's look inside your family. And know what I mean? Like that, I can sense how people would become very defensive.
Not like it.
Yeah.
but in some ways, I believe it's really easy to get someone to change their mind about being involved in a group, especially if it's a really abusive group. That's in some way easy. What's hard is creating an environment for them to come back to that's safe.
Hmm.
So I know that when I left the group I was involved, I didn't tell my parents for 3 years that I had left because it wasn't safe. It was, I was a 23, 24-year-old man having to tell my parents I was wrong. that's a big bite. It was more than I was ready to do. So what we want to do is to make it safe for the person to come home or safe to reconnect with the family. And so part of that, families have to change. You know, it's not just that there's a group and that there's a person involved in the group. There's a lot more to this. There's the relationships that exist between the family members and sort of the whole family system, how that works. That's got to be sort of dissected a bit so that ultimately it's attractive for someone to come back home or back, can reconnect with their family.
Right. And when you speak about families offering that safe space for them to come back into, and your own personal experience, and you know, being this young man, clearly you didn't want to say, okay, I was wrong about every, you know, all of these things that I believed. Were you worried about there being an I told you so factor, or?
Yeah, because there was. Oh. You know, I mean, I think we talked, I was in transcendental meditation, so when I was 17, when I got involved, and my parents were like, okay, is this okay, not okay? They took me to the priest, I got the priest involved, their friend was a therapist, I got the therapist involved, you know, all their friends I got involved. I would get anybody that I could talk to involved in TM. I found out why, you know, it's something that would hook them. The level that they were involved, the level I was involved, was such a different level. I'd ridden the escalator up into the upper levels, you know, where we believed that it take to save the world. And, you know, Senshi Maharshi was God. I was in another world. Mm-hmm. And so coming back, and of course we levitated. So, I mean, you know, coming back, I have my nephew say, hey, yo, Uncle Pat, can you still levitate? You know, does it make it easy?
Right. So there are feelings then of, go on.
No, I mean, just it's not necessarily comfortable.
Right.
So for some people, it makes it difficult for them to reconnect. And I know in my own case, I'd go home to visit my parents and my mother would say, it's 4, we're eating at 6, so you better go meditate. And I'd go sit in a room going, what am I doing? I mean, I don't know how to tell her.
Oh, wow, yeah.
they had paid for me to go to the Maharishi's University, $50,000. You know, and now I'm going to tell them it was wrong?
Okay, how
do I do that?
Oh, that paints a much fuller picture. I mean, because these are feelings of embarrassment and guilt and then shame. Like, if, you know.
All of that.
Yeah.
And I still believed a lot of it, you know, so it's a lot to sort through, and it takes a lot of time for someone to sort through all of those things. So that when I said that it's relatively easy to get someone to reevaluate what's wrong with the group, but this recovery side, it's another story. It's in a way, it's like, look, you're married, you have 2 kids. And somebody comes in and says, okay, your husband's having an affair. Here's a picture of him with his girlfriend. Here's a picture of your bank accounts where your money has been drawn out. Here is the house that he bought for her. And now get on with your life. Well, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you mean get on with my life? I have 2 kids. I love them. All of those confused emotions are there. You might know that I need to get out of this marriage or out of this relationship, but how? And so if you're going to interfere with someone's life, you've got to prepare for that other side of it.
All right.
You know, where are they going to live? If you're in a group that, you know, people live communally, where's the person going to live if they have kids? What's going to happen to the kids? Are you in a position to help them? So a lot of that work has to be thought about ahead of time, so that it makes the most easy way for someone to transition away from where they've been,
right?
Just in some way to reconnect,
right? And you're touching on all of the things that I wanted to address in sort of the last chapter of our talk, which are, you know, common problems that people face once they have had that revelation and are coming out of a group, and how families and friends can support them in the, like, aftermath of, deprogramming through whatever method.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, I can give you a couple of, in some way, humorous examples. There's one woman that we helped work her way out of a particular group. And this group had rules about colors of clothing that you would wear, and also the types of clothing you could wear. So she was out of the group, completely out of the group, and it was time to her, to get a job and those things, but she just couldn't go for interviews. And her parents just were trying to wrap their head around, why can't you just go for an interview?
You mean like a job interview?
Yeah, a job interview. I mean, it's time. You know, you've been out of the group for 6 months, you know.
Okay.
You know, I bought you clothes. You know, why can't you just go and do this?
Right.
Well, where this woman was stuck was in the group she was involved in. You couldn't wear black or certain colors, and you couldn't wear anything with blue jeans. And her parents had bought her jeans, and what was trendy at the time was maybe a black top. So her issue was not going on a job interview. Her issue was, what do I wear?
Wow.
Because she still held those prejudices that those color clothes or that type of clothing was wrong.
Wow. It doesn't leave you all at once. It leaves it gradually.
No, it doesn't leave you. Another woman who's a friend, and she's talked about this publicly, she happens to be a professor now at a university, but she wanted to become a nurse, and she wanted to become a midwife. So after she left the group, that was her desire. So she went on an interview, and in her case, it was at the University of Pennsylvania, which is a pretty Ivy League, pretty stodgy school, and she went for this interview. And she came back after the interview, and she called me, and she said, I don't think the interview went well. And I go, how could it not go well? You have a 4.0, you're a genius, you've got everything possibly going for you. She said, well, they asked me why I wanted to become a midwife. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, I said, so what did you tell them? She said, well, the goddesses told me.
Oh.
And I said, well, you probably did screw up the interview, but what do you mean the goddesses told you? She said, well, when we were in this, meditation thing, these visions would come to me, and these goddesses would come, and they would tell me that this is what my career should be. Well, I'd be like, well, okay, then we need to talk about goddesses. Like, where did you come? How did you start seeing goddesses? Well, it wasn't addressed in the intervention because I didn't know it.
Right. Wow. And
but she didn't get in that year. The next year she got in, she became, ultimately the chair of the department at, a major university, and, her life turned around. But these little things get stuck in the way.
Right. I think too, if considering someone might be in a group where some form of rhetoric was really common and just mm-hmm. accepted all the time, just suddenly yep. being in a completely different community where some topics that you're so used to are now things that you can't mention without yeah. people looking at you like you're crazy, then, it must take a while to filter out the things that are still acceptable and no longer acceptable.
Yeah, and you often, depending upon the length of involvement in a group, you have gaps. What do you do? I was 18, 19, 20. I was at Harvard, and then I'm 32 and I'm not at Harvard anymore because I was in a group where we ate trash.
Oh.
I was thinking about a particular group called the Garbage Eaters, and I was a nomadic Christian. So how do I now, what do I tell people I did for the last 10 years? That, I lived out of dumpsters.
Right.
So that reintegration takes time. And when the more extreme you sort of system you're involved in, or the more intensely you're committed, the recovery side can take some time. But everyone is different, and the human being is resilient. And I see people who come out of some of the most extreme situations that you could imagine, and they pop back to normal life. And you see people leave things that, for me would not be so extreme. And yet people have a hard time readjusting.
Right. Just the layers of emotional and psychological and really practical adjustments that need to be made to your
yeah.
life.
It can
seem overwhelming.
So that's why we spend, in our approach, so much time with families ahead of time to in some way attune them, calibrate them to what it's like coming out. What would be the obstacles for the person? What would be the issues? And so, I'm just working with a family, and they said, well, as soon as he's out, he's got to get a job, and, I've been sending money, and I want my be paid back. And I'm going, oh, wait a minute. You've got to let go of these ideas. Right. Because where you think the person is and where you want them to be is not where they are. That's not practical. And if you expect that, you have unrealistic expectations. So that's a lot of our approach. So I believe that if you can get families to be safe, and if you can get families or people who love someone who's in a group to understand what they love about the group, then you can start having meaningful dialogue when that person is open and ready. And so as I go back to my own experience in the eight or 9 years I was involved, strangers could have gotten me out one day. 2 weeks later, you could have brought in an army and I wouldn't have budged. A month later, I wanted to be out of there. 2 months would go by and you wouldn't have, I wouldn't have budged. All you had to know was what was going on in my head. And so how do you do that? You have to be able to have a dialogue with someone so that they're honest with you.
And keep that communication pathway open all the time.
All the time. All the time. At any cost. And that's sometimes for some people, they just can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so they would rather just try. And I'm not someone who believes that you should just try. We want families to be successful, and we want not just that they're successful in having the person reevaluate their involvement and helping facilitate their reevaluation, but that they're a whole being on the other side, that they have a life that's meaningful to them. And that's not often done by just saying you made a stupid mistake because you were brainwashed. It's a lot more than that.
Right. Well, this conversation.
There's that, but there's that, but there's more.
Mm-hmm. More than ever right now, I'm understanding the need for professionals like yourself to guide families because of just how incredibly nuanced these and ongoing these situations are.
They are. I was just reflecting in what we were talking on another particular case. It was a brother, a family, a brother and a sister. The brother was involved in a very strange group. The sister was not. The parents had bugged their son mercifully. I mean, for months and months and months, like endlessly bombarding him with negative information about the group. And the last thing he wanted to do is talk to his mom and dad about this group. But his sister had never brought up anything. And, we encouraged her not to bring up anything. And so when he came home for a visit, the parents we had got them to sort of slow down on all these criticisms. And the sister went for a hike with her brother in the woods. And she said, if you've noticed, I've said nothing about your involvement. In fact, I've been supportive of it with mom and dad. It's not that I don't have an opinion, but I'm not going to do anything that's going to cause any more conflict in our family. And just that statement, the brother said, well, what do you know? And she said, I know a lot. I've done a lot of research, but I'm not going to share that with you. If you really are looking for an authentic life, if you're really looking for transformation, then you owe it to yourself to do the research. So I'm not going to give it to you. So her letting him know that she knew there was things, but that wasn't going to affect their relationship, and that she wasn't going to share that with mom and dad was a very powerful thing for this young man. So what did he do? He said, okay, at least tell me where to go look. And so she told him where to go look, and he stayed up all night long reading the information. And the next day he asked if, you know, we could talk. And he wanted clarification of certain ideas. But, we don't get people out. They get themselves out. And we just hopefully we give them the skills or the tools or remove the obstacles that keep them from leaving a group.
That was so masterfully done by that woman. And so, I got a little emotional hearing that story. That was really lovely.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Testament to the relationship between a brother and a sister.
Yeah, it can be powerful. And that's what you have to find out. And so in our approach, you know, other people might just come in, they get the whole family together, and they, you know, let them all know what was horrible about it so you can express to the person what's horrible about it. But, and that's not us. My idea is that you go in and you find out who's really connected. Who can we keep connected? You know, who, because you don't want to, like, if there's 10 members of a family, if I was doing an intervention, last thing I would do is have 10 people there. I might have one or two, because we want to keep all of those other relationships as safe as possible, as untainted as possible. Because we want to keep lifelines available back to the family, back to their, you know, the people who care for them. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, if the group falls apart, in the end, all you got is your family.
Right. Well, I would recommend anyone questioning whether or not it's appropriate to even reach out to a professional for a consultation or just more information that they absolutely do it. And I'm hearing from you that there are a wide variety of approaches and types of professionals in this field. So where would you recommend people go to look? If people are listening to this episode and they're on board with your message and they want to reach out to a professional, possibly even yourself, where should they go? Where should they look?
So I don't want to do self-promotion, but, you know, I have a website called mediation.com.
Sorry, you cut out for a second. It's called mediation.com,
yes.
Right? Okay.
That's correct. I would go to an organization like the International Cultic Studies Association, which for the last 40 years has been providing information, doing research, putting on conferences, academic conferences, publishing academic journals, doing really hard research on this field, and also developing workshops for healing for people for their recovery. So the International Cultic Studies Association is a great resource for families, and their website's got probably 50,000 articles, and they maintain, you know, lists of people who are like myself, who work with families. And they put on conferences. This year's is in Manchester, England. Last year was in Philadelphia, where hundreds of people come, and there may be 100, 125 speakers. Many of them have been in groups themselves and gone on and become PhDs or therapists who share their experience. So if it was me, I would want to go to a place like International Cultic Studies Association, go to a conference where I could meet different people and find people whose approach resonates with you and your family system. And those people who regularly publish or regularly speak around the world, they're the ones that you probably want to look for. The last thing, I don't like self-promotion. So if someone's out pushing their own method, it raises questions. It's, I think, better that someone refers you.
Right.
That,
I understand your dislike for self-promotion, but I don't think that it, you know, it's self-promotion for you to guide people to cultmediation.com, because I think that your message specifically might resonate with a lot of people, because I,
yeah.
You know, you have what to me sounds like a unique and very open-minded and very evolved way of viewing these cultic relationships and ways out. And so I...
One last thing. I mean, the monk that I refer to in that story that I was using, who does interfaith dialogue, years ago we had a discussion. He said to me, you know, when I'm working with Islam and trying to have a discussion, you know, theologians sitting down discussing, how do you think we get it going? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, because, you know, we think Jesus is God, they don't. So if we go in, Jesus is God, no, he's not. Yes, he is. No, he's not. We can get nowhere. So where do you think we start? I said, I have no idea. He said, we start with the Virgin Mary. Now, this is obscure again. What does that mean? He said, so when Muhammad and his brother were going around taking all the iconography out of the churches, removing the crosses, because in Islam, you don't have any kind of, imagery. Iconography that's removed. Muhammad's brother went into a particular church and there was one icon, and the icon was of Mary holding the baby, Jesus. And he said, that one can stay. So he said, so where we start is where we agree. We both agree that there was Mary and the baby Jesus. Now, is he God or not? That's another story, but we find the place that we can agree on, and then we move from there. And so I think that at the essence of what we've been talking about is finding things that you can agree on rather than focusing on the things that you disagree on.
Thanks to Patrick Ryan and to you for listening. On next week's episode, Psych, Lola is examined by a state-appointed psychiatrist as well as the defense's star expert witness, Stella Laughlin. They offer contrasting opinions of Lola's psychological state. See you then.